For 200 years, the United States has really wanted a strong and stable China, but it hasn't really had one. But now we actually do have a strong China, perhaps even a stable China, and we don't know what to do with it.
China 21 is produced by the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego's School of Global Policy and Strategy. We are a university-based think tank that produces original research to anchor major policy discussions on China and its relationship to the United States. This podcast features expert voices, insights, and stories about Chinese economy, politics, society, and the implications for international affairs. Learn more at china.ucsd.edu. Welcome to China 21. I'm your host, Samuel Choi. The U.S.-China relationship is currently at a critical juncture, but it's important to understand it as part of a larger pattern in a bilateral relationship that is not only indispensable for the future, but historically rich and complex. In this episode, Paul Pickowitz interviews the acclaimed author John Pomfret about these patterns, based on his vast volume of the U.S.-China story since the very beginning of America's founding, and how it informs the controversies in the current moment of Sino-American relations, ranging from the impact of Chinese students on U.S. universities, Xi Jinping's end to presidential term limits, and trade and business relations. Paul Pickowitz is one of the country's leading historians of modern China, with 15 books engaging across disciplines that investigated the impact of the Cultural Revolution on Chinese peasants, the history of Chinese cinema, Cold War propaganda strategies, and Chinese soft power initiatives. John Pomfret is an award-winning journalist with the Washington Post and is currently a Fulbright Senior Scholar in Beijing. He is the author of the acclaimed book, Chinese Lessons, and has won several awards for his coverage of Asia. He holds degrees from Stanford University and was one of the first American students to study at Nanjing University. Pomfret's latest book, The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, won the 2017 Council on Foreign Relations Arthur Ross Book Award.
Okay, wonderful. We have a guest today, John Pomfret, who is an extremely well-known writer on China. And many of you will know him from the book Chinese Lessons, a copy of which I have in my hand here. Which came out about 2006 or
yes,
so.
Yeah.
And then, but today we're here to talk about the new book, which is hot off the press, called The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. And I think, in my view, that's what's distinctive about the book, is the time span it's covering relations between China and the United States. So probably the best way to start for the listeners is to simply have me ask you, it's almost a 700 page book, so if you use it as bedtime reading, you'll get a nice use out of it. Beautifully written, easy to read, but I wanted to ask you for the soundbite or short version of the scope of the book, and what are the major findings, and then we'll take off from there.
So basically the book is a story of America and China, and it's a story of the relationship, and it stresses how actually fundamentally important both countries were to each other. China was incredibly important to the United States as an early market for American goods, but also as a market that Americans went to actually do significant trading. We became China's number two trading partner by the early 1800s. But on the other side, America became very, very important to China as the Chinese searched for a way to modernize their country. And education became a huge part of that relationship. It started in the 1850s and it's continued to today. I think one of the major findings of the book is actually how deep our relationship has been. Many Americans think that kind of the relationship with China began in 1972 when Richard Nixon went to China, but actually it stretches back. The title is a distortion in a way, because really we began our relationship with China in 1783. So, but that's not a date that resonates in the minds of many Americans. So the publisher tweaked it slightly just to give it a more historical spin. But 1783 was the year that we actually began trading with China and sent the first boat from New York Harbor to China with a load of American-grown ginseng to trade with the Chinese for porcelain, tea, and cloth.
I'm curious about, because you already knew before you started this project, you already knew a tremendous amount about China. You'd lived there extensively and so forth, very deeply involved. But I always like to ask people about surprises. And so as you were doing the research and actually putting the book together, writing the book, what surprised you as somebody who knows a lot about China? Were there any moments at which you said, oh, my goodness?
One of the things that surprised me was there's a period of time from about the 1880s to the 1930s, even to the 1940s, where the ability of people from China and the West to intermingle was extraordinary. And these are people from the top almost of the Chinese political echelon. The cross-pollination in ideas between senior Chinese officials and senior Western officials, the amount of intermarriage that was happening from officials from the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs and foreigners, that kind of mixing of the cultures was something that was really surprising to me, given that today's China really doesn't do that and has, from the late 1990s, increasingly closed itself off from this type of kind of really comfortable intermingling of the two cultures. And that something was sad in a way, but surprising in a sad way.
Yeah. No, I like the fact that you're mentioning that, because it comes out in your writing. You see these people befriending each other, interacting with each other in all sorts of different ways, and surprising and unexpected ways.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you brought that up. The book starts, as you mentioned, in the late 18th century. I'm interested in patterns. So you're looking at a very long period of time. Most books on China-America relations don't cover this length of time. I'm looking for patterns. I'm interested in patterns. What, in your view, are the most important long-term patterns that you detect in China-U.S. relations over this time? Or is it silly to talk about long-term patterns? You know, yes or no on long-term patterns? If so, I suspect you're going to say yes. What are the key ones?
So I agree with the idea that there have been, at least, patterns in the relationship. And on both sides, I think they're quite similar. In the book, I talk about sort of this interminable Buddhist cycle of reincarnation, where Americans and Chinese approach each other with these extremely outsized expectations, which invariably are dashed, and then they collapse into this sort of trough of negativity, which manifests itself in our country often with Red Scare or anti-Chinese pogroms, take your pick, which then are ultimately renewed into very high expectations again. And the Chinese similarly looking at the United States at one moment as the key to their quest for a modern country, for wealth and power, and then looking at the United States several years later as the source of the virus of political rebellion that's going to destabilize China and ruin its culture. And we both flip on and off with these cycles. And right now, clearly, both countries are together in a trough. But I don't know how long, who knows how long it's going to last. But I think we should always be cognizant of the fact that almost in the past, almost after every trough, there's this rising expectation and this renewed, almost illogical, irrational hope for each other.
Well, you've anticipated my next question, because given my interest in patterns, I was going to ask you, are any of these patterns still in play today? Or is today a qualitatively new and different kind of situation? And of course, I'm referring to I brought several copies of the New York Times with me. All you have to do is open the New York Times and you're going to get inundated with the problems that characterize the relationship in the recent weeks and months. But so could you talk a bit more specifically about the extent to which the patterns you've discussed are in fact still in play today, or are we in danger if we talk about patterns that have always been, will always be? Does that then become too confining and not allowing us to see something that really is new and different?
Great, that's a great question. On one level, I think there are patterns that are continuing today, that are happening today, that have echoes in the past. And for example, it would be FBI Chief Christopher Wray's recent comment that dealing with Chinese influence peddling operations or espionage operations in the United States would demand what he called a whole of society response. And while I am cognizant of the fact of Chinese espionage activities in the United States being naturally of significant threat to the United States, I think embracing a whole of society response echoes very much sort of a potential McCarthyite operation mm-hmm. against Chinese influence in the United States in the 1950s. And that can't we do it differently this time is a natural question that mm-hmm. that raises in my mind. What I do think is new and different now that in some ways could draw into question this whole we're stuck in a Buddhist cycle of reincarnation point is that for 200 years, the United States has really wanted a strong and stable China, but it hasn't really had one. But now we actually do have a strong China, perhaps even a stable China, and we don't know what to do with it. And so we are facing a China that we've hoped would be strong and that we hope would be stable. Now we've got one.
Got it.
And so that is actually, we haven't had
that's
that.
New.
That is very new. And we've worked almost tirelessly for more than 100 plus years to try to build that China, except for this, you know, the interregnum of America's Cold War with China. But that was an anomalous period in our history of engagement with the Chinese. But now we've got a strong China, and I think our fundamental assumption was that as China became stronger, it would become more like us. Mm-hmm. And currently, clearly right now, it's not on that trajectory. And I think that is a very new and different mm-hmm. issue for us.
Okay, good. Yeah. One of the many things I like about the book is that you look at China-American relations over a very long period of time, China-America perceptions of one another. You look at them at two levels. So at lunch today, I'd say 99.99% of the discussion was about elite politics.
Right.
So national leaders, official state policy, and yeah. so forth. You do a lot of that.
Yeah.
But you also take a look at ordinary citizens on both sides of this divide, the China-U.S. Relationship. So you're interested in what elites are saying and doing and how, quote, policy can change from time to time. But you also raise the question, and you've had your own intimate experiences as a student in China, interacting with people who aren't officials,
right.
people you meet on the street, people you bump into who, guess what, they have views, they have ideas. So I'd like to talk about that a little bit more. Do you think there's sometimes a gap or a tension between these two things, that is to say, what national leaders and official policymakers are saying on the one hand, and what their own citizens think and believe. You know, that is to say, the state advances, whether it's the American state or the Chinese state, the state advances an official position, but many citizens question or reject it in one way or another. Or do citizens just adjust to and parrot the latest official viewpoint about China or about America? So I'd like to get you to talk a little bit about, first, do you agree that there are these two levels, let's call it the official and the unofficial, and to what extent can there be and has there been tension where we should not assume that what's being said by state leaders is something that gets internalized by ordinary citizens?
Yeah, I think clearly there have been times, and there are currently, I think you're also seeing a significant gap in the Chinese state-run perception or their image of the United States that they try to tell their people to look at, and versus the, not quote-unquote average, but versus many Chinese have a different view of America as well. An example would be, And the Chinese state has also a schizophrenic view of America itself, right? On one hand, they look at the United States as a hostile Western force. At the other hand, every communist leader since Deng Xiaoping has sent his son or daughter to the United States to study. And Deng Xiaoping is proud that his grandson was an American citizen, born in the U.S. of A. Yeah. And so even on the state level of elite politics, yep. there is significant schizophrenia in how America is viewed. And then when it trickles down to the Chinese masses, if you will, again, it's also schizophrenic because a Chinese at this, you know, I remember when the United States blew up the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia in 1999, I believe. There were massive, I was in China at the time, there were massive anti-American demonstrations, both in Beijing and Chengdu and other cities. But the same guys who were demonstrating, whom I interviewed on the street, were like, well, after we finish throwing rocks at the embassy, we're going to line up and get a visa there.
Yeah.
Somewhat cynical, but nonetheless,
yeah.
I think it's illustrative of the schizophrenic way or the very difficult way, contradictory way that Chinese have viewed us. Yeah. And I think similarly for Americans as well.
Yeah. If it actually anticipated my last question, which was going to be a humor question, a funny question, but I'll jump to it right now and then go back. So I had written down here, I cannot and have never been able to understand why Xi Jinping sent his daughter to Harvard. back to patterns again, is there a long-term pattern at work here that explains that? And in some ways you've already answered that, you know, or is it a contradictory interweaving of more than one pattern?
I think that the threat and the temptation that the United States presents to China are very similar in a way, because they both come from the chaotic innovation inherent in the American society, in American democracy. And the innovation is something that has transfixed mm-hmm. Chinese. But the chaos is something that has specifically made both the nationalists but also the communists quite worried, because mm-hmm. it demands a fluidity in a political situation that the Chinese don't really want, the leadership at least doesn't want to tolerate. But it comes from the same root, mm-hmm. I think. And I think similarly with American perceptions of the Chinese, particularly sort of these issues of industriousness versus kind of cheating. Mm-hmm. And I think Americans have huge respect for the industriousness of the Chinese and of China, but then that bleeds into kind of, oh, the Chinese are using some type of secret sauce. Mm-hmm. it kind of yellow peril stuff that we've seen happening as well. I think they both come from the same, a similar source as well.
Yeah. You only mentioned Donald Trump's name once in the book, very briefly at the end, but it's in the context of the campaign.
Yeah.
And that he and Bernie Sanders are on the same page on the economic issues and so forth. But the book came out, I imagine if you could add a chapter now, I'd love to know what you'd say. But let's talk about the current climate of what I would call harsh and critical official positions. And so Trump has said, you know, China is raping our economy. Xi Jinping has said America seeks to constrain and keep China down and so forth. So this raises the question, I think a lot of, you know, general readers, some, the kind of people who would be very interested in your book, might wonder, when you hear the harshness of some of these official proclamations, how widespread do you think, and I'll just use this stereotypic term, how widespread do you think at the moment anti-China views are in the United States? I mean, how serious is it? How many people, without necessarily a lot of knowledge or information, just somehow repeat these kinds of assertions? And similarly, in your opinion, since you go to China a lot and you interact with lots of friends and colleagues in China, how anti-U.S. are ordinary Chinese citizens? I mean, to what extent do we see the same kind of very concerning stereotypic views in this environment when officialdom is making very, very headline-catching
right.
One-liners about the nature of these people or those people? Yeah. So so back to the basic question, how deeply rooted at the moment?
Yeah.
March 2018, how deeply rooted is anti-China sentiment in popular America? How deeply rooted is anti-U.S. sentiment in popular China.
So I think on the anti-Chinese sentiment in the United States, I think it is very much a regional issue. And that in some pockets of the United States, the anti-Chinese sentiment is very strong, especially in areas that have been hit by manufacturing losses. Anyone who used to work in the furniture industry in Western Virginia, in West Virginia, I think there's a natural, which is basically picked up and moved to China. You have people also in manufacturing areas in Wisconsin and Michigan who have been directly affected by Chinese competition. I think Trump was extremely successful at harnessing that anti-Chinese sense in his campaign proclamations as a way to get the backing of these people. And I think he fed into a belief that the Chinese had cheated America and had, because of the Chinese market and because of the vagaries of American capitalism, basically American producers came to the conclusion that it was cheaper to make the refrigerator in China, so let's move production there. And I think that among the working class, many people in the working class in China, there was significant damage because of the China shock. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been proven.
So there's a social class dimension to this, you're saying, in the U.S. and regional. Yeah. What about the China side, where we see the most outspoken, the most militant anti-U.S. postures? What's the demography of that voice?
So, and demography is different in China, and it's mostly younger men. Of military age, even though very few of them actually serve in the military, who are products of the patriotic education campaign movement, which has taught them that for not decades, but for centuries, the United States has been part of a cabal of Western nations, including Japan, which have worked together to keep China down. Mm-hmm. And I think that as that generation ages, however, that type of knee-jerk, resentful nationalism does diminish over time.
Yeah.
As people travel to this country, spend more time here, not necessarily among Chinese students, because I think that's a different group of people. And I don't think the United States actually does a very good job of acculturating Chinese students in the United States at this point in our time. I think we did a better job in the 1980s than we do now for a variety of reasons. But I think that's the group, that's the demographic in the Chinese. It's very much a male-oriented demographic that have been convinced that the United States is there to keep China down.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation because the gendered nature of that particular voice in China. I happen to agree with you, and I actually find the same thing here. I want to talk about universities now, because all of us have lots of students from China in our classes, and I don't want to generalize, but my own experience has been when it comes to insecurities and a lack of self-confidence, I find it among Chinese students, it's more likely to be the male students who are more defensive about something that gets said about China, and for some reason I don't quite understand why. Women are more open-minded, more curious about things, you seem to be saying that in China too, there's a gendered dimension to this issue. But let's get back to university. So here we are at the University of California, San Diego, and we were chatting about this earlier. We have currently something like 3,500 students, passport holding students from China on the campus, undergraduate as well as graduate. So getting back to this slowly growing anti-China voice, what about campuses? What about our university campuses? So for example, recently there's been a lot of online discussion back and forth about what's happening on our campuses with so many Chinese students. So my question about this is, will U.S. educators increasingly start to see Chinese spies and operatives infiltrating our universities and imposing censorship norms in our classrooms and in our professional research? Better not to do this kind of research. Better not to teach this kind of class. I guess we'd call it nationalistic concern that leaders in China have, and the disinclination to have things said anywhere in the world, including in our classrooms here, that, quote, makes China look bad, that's critical and so forth. I worry sometimes that this is going to, I mean, it's already out there, that this kind of concern, you see it in school newspapers. We had a visit here last year by the Dalai Lama, which caused a big stir, very controversial in various kinds of ways. We can chat about that in a moment, too. But does this worry you as well? Do you feel like the political moment that's growing out of the topics you discuss in your book is lending itself to a paranoia, perhaps, a quasi-paranoia or a stereotyping among people who really have never had that much contact with Chinese culture and history, but suddenly they're hearing things that, oh, you have to be careful about this or that, and so forth.
So it's difficult to sort of predict the future because it's about something that hasn't happened yet, but I think that clearly there are legitimate concerns about Chinese influence on free debate in U.S. universities that I think that are completely legitimate. But the issue then is it's really on the institutions in the United States to stand up to whatever Chinese pressure might be put on them, and to be proud of our democratic and free amendment, First Amendment traditions, to push back on any potential influence. And it's not like this is purely fantasy, because you've seen Chinese students and Chinese pressure put on Australian institutions in a much more open and brash way than has happened yet in the United States. And if Australia is the test case, we need to make sure that it doesn't move from Australia to the United States. And there's things that we can do. First, in better acculturating Chinese students into American society, and continuing our traditions of open debate, and also among the China, the group of Americans who study China, to continue to push against self-censorship. And the Chinese now, of course, have been very smart about doling out visas to scholars whom they believe to be acceptable, and then blocking other scholars who they believe are not acceptable. And I think there needs to be a reckoning amongst the American academic community that has a decades-long investment in China, that the Chinese can't pick and choose their friends like this. Because we don't do that with Chinese scholars, right? We let pretty much everyone in who wants to study the United States. No one, to my knowledge, no Chinese person, to my knowledge, has ever been blocked from coming to America because of what they've written about the United States back in China. I mean, there's some rabidly anti-American people who've come to America on research tours, et cetera, and they've been welcomed in the United States. And I think that that type of reciprocity should be a basic demand of the U.S. government. We haven't made that demand, ever. But I think these things, there needs to be vigilance in the university, not a red scare, but vigilance, because it's happened in Australia, which is a free society like our own. But there also needs to be pushback against some Chinese practices, which I think are particularly odious and unnecessary.
Good. Yeah. I mean, it's a coincidence that your visit to our campus happens to come at a very special political moment, namely in the last week or two, all sorts of news has been breaking about China. Xi Jinping wants to be, president forever. And what are the ramifications and implications of this? Everyone's, wringing their hands trying to figure. Both my friends in China who are sending me emails, and they're doing the same thing. They're wondering, what's the meaning of this? What will the fallout of this be? I read the New York Times every morning, and recently the New York Times expressed the view that many experts, people that is to say who, like you and me, who know something about China, many experts now feel that China is no longer slowly, quote, converging with the U.S., that somehow the tide has shifted. I wonder if you share this view. The converging theory is called now in the New York Times a romantic notion that needs to be abandoned. And so I'm wondering whether this sounds more like, is it one of your patterns? Is it a downturn pattern that we've seen over, since the late 18th century? Or is this well, maybe sharing some of those characteristics, but this is a bit scary.
So I think it's a bit scary. I also think the convergence idea basically ended in 1989 and not last week. But
with the Tiananmen massacre.
With the Tiananmen Square crackdown and the purging of hundreds of people within the Chinese system who had actually worked closely to try to, who seemed to have backed the idea of ultimate convergence. Mm-hmm. And they were out by the end of 89, early 1990. And so I think the convergence idea ended then, for the time being, though. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in a trough now, but just given my sense of the younger generation in China, yes, there's intense nationalism amongst these people, but there's also intense greed and intense desire for more personal freedom than the previous generation had. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to college with people who matriculated in 78, graduated in 82, got their first paycheck of about the equivalent of $125 a month, and everything in their life was controlled. Like when they married, yep. If they could have a kid. If they wanted to quit their job, they needed their approval of their boss to go get another job. Right? I mean, it's just, you know, and that personal freedom is now expanded exponentially.
There's no going back to
There's
that.
There's no going back. And so, from that perspective, and the demands of their kids for more freedom, clean air, rice which is not poisoned with heavy metals, these demands will rise, and the next generation will have even more demands. And so over a generational expanse, I think that China's ultimately going to move to a freer society. We are in a trough right now, but one could also look at Xi Jinping's president of forever, of everything for life. This type of sort of political shenanigan is not so much a sign of the strength of China's Leninist system, but a sign of the ultimate instability of China's Leninist system. That somebody at the top of the system should be able to proclaim themselves dictator for life, I think from my mm-hmm. perspective, is a sign of China's weakness, mm-hmm. not of its strength. Yes, it's going to give medium-term stability, but in the long term, it's creating the foundations for a very nasty political fight, which could have ramifications for the party's rule.
So you're sober, on the other hand, about the moment, but on the other hand, I'm reading you as being guardedly, maybe a bit more than guardedly optimistic in the longer run. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's a fair statement.
Okay. Yeah, because your friend and mine, Orville Schell, was quoted recently in the New York Times talking about this phenomenon of fairly recent disillusionment experienced by many sectors of American society as being something very serious. So quoting Orville now, the U.S. military is gone, the intellectuals are gone, civil society is gone, and now the businessmen are gone. And that actually, of that formulation, I was most struck by the last. So he further quoted as saying, you'd have to say we're on diverging pathways. This sounds like a very serious alarm bell, especially when you throw the business community in there. Words like gone, it sounds like you're gone, there's no coming back. Do you think he's going too far here?
I think that it's important to sound the alarm bells on something like this, but it's also important to realize that China's still our number one trading partner.
Yeah.
And it's not like that relationship is ended. In fact, the only dialogue that is currently ongoing between the United States and China is a military dialogue. So the Pentagon, not so much gone, but they're vigilant, but they're engaged. And so, I mean, but China is so big right now, there is no alternative but engagement. The question is, how do you engage China? And this idea that we can kind of return to a containment strategy or a strategy of isolation of China is just, it's ridiculous. It's impossible. They're going to be the biggest economy in the world. We have a massive trading relationship with them. Almost anything that's done importantly in science, be it genetics or medicine, has a China component to it. Hmm. So we need to get used to that. At the same time, also understand that we are strategic rivals.
Yeah.
And how we kind of square that circle is the challenge for us. Well, we cannot basically say, they're gone, forget about it. Yeah. I mean, that's just not the way the relationship is.
Too one-dimensional.
And also, we're too deeply intertwined.
Yeah. So trade, actually, you mentioned trade, and that was actually my next point I wanted to raise, because on the heels of some of these other articles that have appeared in the papers recently in quotations about the immediacy of the problems. The New York Times, another quotation from a recent issue, corporate America has long acted as a lubricant for the relationship. So, and you actually talk a lot about that in the book. You go all the way back to the late 18th century, and it's not exactly corporate America, but it's the merchant community, the business community. It's people who are out there trying to figure out a way to make money. We had them in the late 18th century. We've had them at every moment along the way, right up to the present time. So a moment ago, we were talking about a bifurcation, elites on the one hand and ordinary people on the other hand. But there's this other stratum in the middle that you also talk a lot about.
Yeah.
And these are the people out there wheeling and dealing and doing business. So what about this idea as corporate America as a lubricant for the relationship? What role are they playing, do you think, currently, and are they likely to play in untangling this low point we're in?
So, you clearly see in the business community a weakening of their enthusiasm for China, as China has continued to pursue this mercantilist economic policy and effectively import substitution. And then also these policies of forced technological transfer, where any American company with significant technology needs to basically share that technology with the Chinese government, because of their involvement in setting standards, which then goes out the back door and becomes your competitor from another Chinese company within a couple of years. And that has alienated a lot. And so after the United States and the Chinese were involved in effectively a de facto alliance to take down the Soviet Union, security no longer could become the ballast in the relationship, and so the business community became the ballast. And it's not the ballast anymore. Mm-hmm. It's much more divided. There are businesses which continue to make huge amounts of money in China, and businesses like Facebook, which are desperate to get into China to tap into the Chinese market, who obviously would lobby the United States government to maintain good ties with, or Starbucks would be another example.
Okay.
But on the other side, there's businesses who just have been completely ripped off by the Chinese.
Yeah.
And their numbers are growing. So how can the business community, I think now the issue is, and from my perspective, I agree with Orville, that the ball is really in China's court. China needs to understand how deeply its mercantilist policies and its foreign policy have alienated all of its friends in the United States. You have people who for years have been effectively pro-China in within the U.S. government, who are now much more worried about the Chinese as a threat than they used to be. Mm. And the Chinese don't seem at this point either to understand or to care. And I think it's in order to kind of, someone asked me earlier today, what can we do to set the relationship back on track? And I think that the only thing that can happen is we need to change our policy towards China to become much less romantic, to use the New York Times world. But the Chinese also have to understand that they're also at fault in how this relationship is, the trajectory of the relationship. And if they don't, I think the situation will become much more serious.
Okay, so this reminds me of an old, talk about stereotypic terms, the notion of, myth of the China market.
Right.
So we can go way back when, and so again, that's what's lovely about the book, because you talk about economic interest in China on America's part, and this concept keeps on coming up. How much is myth? How much is reality?
Right.
And people will fall down on that in different, on a scale of 1 to 10, there'll be people saying it's all myth, and others are saying, no, it's, there are real opportunities there.
Right.
So do you find that a useful concept at all, or do we need to trash it?
I think that now, if anyone in their home turns over any piece of equipment they have in their room, they're going to see three words on it. It's going to be made in China. And so from their perspective, there was no myth of the American market. And if you look at corporate profits from major American companies like, for example, Apple, clearly they've done a huge amount of successful business in China as well. And so I think it's no longer a myth. The issue is, how can the relationship be made more reciprocal with reciprocity being introduced into the relationship, the trading relationship, not in terms of the surplus of trade. I think that's a very much of a straw man, a complete red herring, but in terms of access to each other's markets, both as sellers and as investors. And clearly the Chinese market is much more close to the United States than our market is to them, both in terms of investment and in terms of exports. Right. And the Chinese will say, well, if the Americans would lift the Tiananmen Square sanctions and export, you know, American weaponry, everything would be great. Mm. And that's just such a tiny percentage of the potential trade. That is also a red herring as well. So we both have red herrings on each side. But I think only if that begins to change can the business community return to its position as the ballast of the relationship. The question is whether the Chinese have any interest in doing it.
Okay, so I have three relatively short questions and then we'll wrap it up, I think. So one of them is this talk now about, literally today, about trade sanctions, right, against China. How do you think China will react? I mean, I'm putting you on the spot. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen, but I think the listeners would be interested to know what you think China's reaction to trade sanctions might be.
So they will take action they will target American exports, and they can also, because they're not dumb, they can target American exports from places that the Republican Party needs to win. So, for example, why not target American wheat? Why not target American soybeans from states that are traditionally Republican states? Why not go after other American businesses that are prominent in Republican areas in order to threaten the Republican Party, to really increase pressure on Trump's party to roll back the sanctions, potential sanctions on. Although right now the sanctions are targeting steel and aluminum,
right,
and Chinese exports of steel and aluminum really only of steel in particular, it's only 2% of American imports, yep, of steel are Chinese. Now they export around the world, of course, and their overcapacity has lowered the global price of steel. So they're actually, they're involved in this problem. But targeting steel is actually a way for us actually to hurt our allies more than our competitor China in this case. But I think the Chinese will definitely do tit-for-tat tariffs. Invariably, chicken is an issue because the Chinese buy all of the chicken parts that the United States doesn't eat, including claws, et cetera, and beaks. And so that will probably be blocked. Even though once it's blocked in China, you're going to see the exports of these things to Hong Kong, go through the roof, and then they'll be taken over into China by rail.
So the next one, next to last question is, and I'm very serious about this. We need to think about this possibility, and that is new Cold War.
Yeah.
New Cold War. In other words, I'm going to guess and say you probably don't think the chances of this are zero, but you probably don't think that the chances of a new Cold War, U.S.-China, 100%. How seriously should we take that idea that we're in, as you say, a low in terms of this long-term patterns of ups and downs, we're in a down moment, we don't know how much deeper the hole is going to get. To what extent should we be thinking seriously that it could actually evolve into a longer-term Cold War type situation, or is this just naive and we shouldn't worry about that?
I think that there's not just an American backlash against China that's coming, but it's a global backlash against China.
Please expand on that.
So when the United States pulled out of TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when the Trump administration pulled him, the assumption was that the Trans-Pacific Partnership was going to collapse, and that the countries of Asia on the Pacific Rim would not be able to hold it together without the Americans, and that the Chinese version of the TPP, which the Chinese call the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, would dominate the rules of trade in East Asia. Well, TPP hasn't collapsed. TPP 11 is alive and well, pushed by the Japanese and the Australians, and it's a trading bloc that doesn't exclude China. It welcomes China if China can follow a rules-based, much more open trading system than China currently has. And it's a sign that the countries of the Asia Pacific, mostly democracies, have come to the conclusion that even without the United States, they need a trading relationship amongst themselves that is not dominated by China. And that's clearly a reaction to the threat that China's mercantilist policies pose to a free trading system. You also see the Europeans, the EU, very concerned with Chinese investment in the EU and the taking of and specifically German, but also French, high technology back to China to create competitors. And the EU is also concerned about China's abilities to leverage their influence in the Eastern European part of the European Right. Union as a way to push policies that are considered, you know, pro-Beijing policies as well. India as well is becoming increasingly a bulwark, looking at itself as a bulwark against Chinese influence in the subcontinent. And so these three factors, TPP in Asia, India, and the European Union, are proceeding on a track that is increasingly worried about China without the United States. Mm-hmm. We're a party in the conversation, but because of the Trump administration's position of America first, we're a significantly less important player as a leader than we used to be. And I think that is, from my perspective, part of this emerging global backlash. Now, there are parts of the world, Africa, Latin America, Eurasia, that are not seized about concerns of China, but I think that's actually a work in progress. Because with One Belt, One Road, the Chinese infrastructure build-out policies, that creates great opportunities in a way for those countries to get great benefits from China, but also creates great risks of being in these sort of debt diplomacy traps, of owing China billions and billions and billions of dollars, which could potentially become political factors in those countries. It already has in Sri Lanka, for example, and very well could in Pakistan as well, and it has in some nations in Africa too.
Great. Well, I mean, there's a lot to watch. This is fabulous. So I have one more question, but I just want to say to our audience, our guest today is John Pomfret, who's been talking about his wonderful new book, The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America in China, 1776 to the present. I recommend it. It's a fun read, and you get an education along the way. My last question then is, what's next? What's the next book going to be about? Have you started it already?
Yeah, it's a book unrelated to China. It's a spy story, not a novel. It's a true story about how the United States and Poland actually became very close intelligence allies. And it has a connection to China in a way, because it also involves something that happened on June 4th, 1989, which was not the Tiananmen Square crackdown. It was the first free election in modern Poland's history.
Wow. Yeah. Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you for listening to China 21, the podcast of the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Visit china.ucsd.edu and connect with us on social media. 谢谢大家.